Yeah. And also there's the generational issue too. And of course, the generational divide has come up, especially around communicating the issues related to the war on Gaza and so many other. And we unfortunately are really at the end of that. But I don't know if you have a thought on that as well. We have about 35 seconds, I would say.
I will do my best on communicating around Gaza or
Yeah. And also with the fact that it really seems to have created a stark generational and in some cases community divides as well.
Yes, I will just say briefly that one of the challenges is that it's not possible to communicate about such a big, important, difficult issue in 30-second sound bites that often are the forum on social media platforms, because there's decades of history, because there's pain in Israel from the events of October 7th, because there is humanitarian devastation in Gaza, because there are many things happening at the same time. And I don't have a solution to that other than to say that discussion is probably better than 30-second sound bites, especially on issues that are as heart-wrenching and difficult as that one.
Noelle writes, Joe Biden should campaign along the lines of Reagan's Morning in America strategy. Focus on the positive. Focus on hope. Focus on bringing the noise down. Well, Jen Psaki, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today. Thanks so much for coming on Forum.
My pleasure, Mina. Thanks so much. I really enjoyed talking to you, too.
The book is Say More. Work, the White House and the World. Caroline Smith produced today's segment. Thank you, listeners, for your questions and comments. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
We're going to head out to Fremont now, just ahead of Here and Now, and find out about a crash on the Nimitz Freeway with Elaine Lee Young.
Dave, it was a minor incident, South 880 at Stevenson. The good news, it's been moved off to the shoulder of the off-ramp. It is still slow from Mowry Avenue. Sunol Grade, we've got road work, southbound 680 starting at Andrade. The right lane is coned off there. Bay Bridge metering lights are off. Just a bit sluggish, center anchorage into the city. Elaine Lee Young for KQED.
Elaine, thanks so much. Traffic support with Elaine Lee Young comes to us from Murphy McKenna Construction. And support for KQED comes from Xfinity with their Wi-Fi Boost Pod. In-home wall-to-wall Wi-Fi offers coverage throughout the home. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary. You're listening to KQED FM 88.5 San Francisco, KQEI FM 89.3 North Highland Sacramento, live online at kqed.org, and if you have a smart speaker, ask it to play KQED. 11 o'clock.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Deepa Fernandez. It's Here and Now.
Coming up, President Biden's son Hunter goes on trial for firearms-related charges. He's pleading not guilty. We'll get the latest from the courthouse in Delaware.
Also, reaction from New Hampshire voters to the conviction of Donald Trump and that a convicted felon is running for president.
It's not good for our country at all. I also think it's horrible that he could become the next president of the United States.
And wildfires on the island of Maui last year destroyed the homes of 4,000 families. One plan would convert short-term vacation rentals into longer-term housing.
90% of them are owned by people who don't live in Hawaii. So this is what's underpinned, you know, the activists.
Coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Just days after former President Donald Trump's criminal hush money trial ended in a conviction, President Biden's son Hunter is on trial on gun charges in Delaware. Hunter Biden is accused of lying about his drug addiction at the time he filled out a gun purchasing form. He's also charged with unlawful possession of a firearm. Jury selection is underway. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports on who's expected to testify for the prosecution.
They've said in filings in an open court that they expect to call around a dozen witnesses. That includes Hunter's ex-wife, Kathleen Buell, as well as the widow of his brother, Beau, Haley Biden. Hunter had a romantic relationship with her after Beau died. Prosecutors say that Haley Biden will testify that Hunter had the gun in question, that she threw it into a dumpster outside a market in Wilmington less than 2 weeks after he bought it. That gun was later found by a man collecting recyclables. He's the one who turned it over to law enforcement.
NPR's Ryan Lucas reporting. First Lady Jill Biden accompanied her stepson to the courthouse today. The Atlantic hurricane season is here, and forecasters are predicting it will be one of the most active on record because of climate conditions and abnormally warm ocean temperatures. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports that has the Air Force's weather reconnaissance unit, the Hurricane Hunters, bracing for a busy tropical season at a time when the squadron is spread thin.
The 53rd Weather Reconnaissance Squadron is the only U.S. military unit tasked to collect real-time information for forecasters. They fly directly into the eyewall of dangerous storms. Colonel William McGee is the maintenance group commander who keeps the Hurricane Hunter fleet up and running at Keesler Air Force Base in Biloxi, Mississippi.
I think of this as a combat mission. We are protecting our coastline from these storms.
The Hurricane Hunters track tropical systems in the Atlantic and Pacific, but also winter storms in the Northeast and atmospheric rivers on the West Coast. McGee says resources are stretched with increasing demand, yet the same number of planes and crew. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
Cross-border fire has increased in recent weeks along the Israel-Lebanon border. NPR's Daniel Estrin has the latest from Tel Aviv.
Israeli warplanes bombed Hezbollah sites in Lebanon over the weekend, and recent rockets from Hezbollah sparked fires in Israeli-held territory. Israel says all branches of its military took part in exercises last week to prepare for a potential war along Israel's northern front with Lebanon. President Biden is urging a ceasefire deal in Gaza, which he says can lead to calm along the Israel-Lebanon border. But some Israeli officials are calling for a war, including the conservative education minister, who says an Israeli offensive should push Hezbollah militants and Lebanese civilians further north away from Israel's border. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
From Washington, this is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt in San Francisco, where transit workers have rejected a tentative labor deal with the city. The Chronicle reports that a large majority of a transport workers union local chapter voted last week against a deal offered by the city. The union represents light rail and bus operators, fare inspectors, and mechanics, among others. It's unclear why the deal was rejected. The union's current contract expires at the end of this month. TWU and San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency officials have yet to comment. The arraignment of three City of Alameda police officers charged with involuntary manslaughter in the 2021 death of Oakland resident Mario Gonzalez was postponed last week because one of the officers is living in South Africa. The Alameda County Superior Court approved the two-month postponement to give Officer Eric McKinley time to move with his family back to the Bay Area and defend himself in court. Allison Barry Wilkinson is an attorney for one of the officers. She says Officer McKinley went to South Africa last December to work as a missionary.
Everyone would like this case to proceed forward expeditiously, but the circumstances were such that everyone was in agreement.
If convicted, the officers face up to 4 years in prison. There's more Bay Area news at KQED.org. I'm Brian Watt.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from Sattva, offering 9 different mattresses, including the Sattva Classic, a mattress with 2 layers of coils designed to provide comfort and support. Learn more at Sattva, SAATVA.com. And the listeners, members, and sustaining members of KQED. Heat advisory in effect starting tomorrow for the Bay Area through Thursday. In the meantime, cloudy to partly cloudy skies today. The cool day today, mid-60s to the mid-80s. Warm to hot weather starts tomorrow. Bay Area highs, mid-60s to the upper 90s inland. Cloudy skies generally for Sacramento today. The Weather Service says today's highs 80 to 88 in the valley. Warm to hot tomorrow and sunny. Highs 98 to 104.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks in Boston.
And I'm Vipa Fernandez in Alameda, California. It's Here and Now. Hunter Biden's federal gun trial begins in Delaware today.
Prosecutors allege that Hunter Biden lied about his drug use on a federal gun form used to purchase a .38-caliber Colt Cobra revolver. According to prosecutors, Hunter Biden was addicted to crack cocaine at the time. Hunter Biden's team has long claimed that the trial is politically motivated to weaken his father, President Joe Biden. The White House has declined to comment, but this is clearly a personal matter for the president. Biden has kept his son close in recent months, and this morning, First Lady Jill Biden was seated in the first row of the courtroom. The trial comes at a critically important time in Biden's re-election campaign. For more, let's bring in Jonathan Lemire. He's White House Bureau Chief for Politico. Hey, Jonathan.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm doing well, Jonathan. Before we get into the latest, please remind us how we got to this point of the trial. Many listeners might remember that a plea deal was reached in this case last year. Why did that deal collapse?
You're certainly right. This has been a long time in coming, and Hunter Biden has been a favorite target for those on the right for some years now. Donald Trump's campaign tried to make him a central issue in 2020. Polls suggest it didn't have much traction with voters. Hunter Biden writes a lot about this, his drug addiction, in his very brutally honest memoir, and charges were brought. The investigation a few years in the coming, and last year they looked like they were on the verge of a plea deal. In which Hunter Biden would have pleaded guilty to this crime, but would have avoided trial and therefore avoided any kind of prison time. But that deal fell apart. The judge thought it deemed it too favorable. And so the investigation continued, and the special prosecutor, who was appointed by Donald Trump, but allowed to continue his investigation by the current Department of Justice under the Attorney General Merrick Garland, appointed by President Biden, brought these charges. And now today, the trial begins with jury selection in a courtroom in Wilmington, Delaware.
This is a lot to follow. So jury selection has begun. Do we know about the key witnesses the defense and the prosecution plan to call?
This is expected to be a pretty brief trial, certainly shorter than what we just saw with former President Trump. Estimates say a week or two at tops. The two signature witnesses here, the ones that are going to get the most attention and cause the most personal pain, for President Biden, his close advisors tell me, Hunter Biden's ex-wife, Kathleen, and then Hallie Biden, who is the former wife of Beau Biden. Beau Biden is the president's other son who passed away of cancer 9 years ago. And after Beau Biden's passing, Hallie Biden and Hunter Biden briefly had a relationship. And in fact, it was Hallie Biden who discovered the gun here in question. So this is going to be, you know, beyond its legal ramifications and possible political fallout. It's simply one that's a deeply personal one for a president who frequently says he keeps his family at the center of his life.
Mm. Now, Hunter Biden has long claimed the trial against him is politically motivated. Any evidence of that?
Some legal experts tend to agree with him, saying these are charges that are not usually brought for a first-time offender, and, you know, certainly not, you know, or offered a plea deal is common. So Hunter Biden has taken an extremely aggressive tact in recent months. He hired outside counsel, and we should be clear, the White House not involved with his defense. President Biden is keeping his distance from it for fear of being, for any accusations that he might be trying to interfere with the trial. But you're right. Hunter Biden has for long said that he believes he is being prosecuted simply because of his last name. But we should note that not just in 2020, but since then, Republicans have really tried to make Hunter Biden allegations of corruption, that he tried to profit off of his father's name, his father's business dealings, even suggesting that President Biden was somehow involved. They provided no evidence of that. These charges had nothing to do with that. And at least to this point, polls suggest that Americans simply don't really care. In fact, there are some that believe that this is actually makes President Biden look more sympathetic because so many Americans have loved ones who grapple with addiction.
You know, we should mention Hunter Biden is also facing a tax charge for which he'll stand trial in September. This is for the gun. This is the gun charge. But just in our final moments, President Biden is very close with his son, Hunter, and is reportedly very worried about what could happen to him. You spoke with White House advisors anonymously. What did they tell you about the potential psychological impact of this trial on the president?
They're far more worried about the psychological and personal toll than the political one. They don't believe that many voters will cast their ballots this November because of Hunter Biden, whether it's this trial in Delaware or the later one in California. But President Biden, you know, is someone whose family has been hit with a lot of tragedy. His first wife was killed in a car accident, as well as his baby daughter. In fact, Hunter and Beau Biden were both grievously injured in that accident. This was back in the 1970s. He lost Beau Biden to cancer less than a decade ago. So he speaks to Hunter Biden, as I have reported, two or three times a day, either by call or text. And he put out a statement today saying that I'm a president, but I'm also a dad. And he says, Jill and I love our son, and we are so proud of the man he is today. And he says he won't be commenting about the case, but he is deeply proud of Hunter Biden.
Jonathan Lemire, White House Bureau Chief for Politico. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
My pleasure.
As of April, nearly 9,000 migrants have enrolled in Chicago public schools. Many of these students and their families have found permanent housing through a state program that helps cover their rent. But that means lots of these migrant kids are struggling in the city's segregated school system that has an acute shortage of bilingual teachers. That's the conclusion of reporting by Rima Amin. She wrote about this for our editorial partner Chalkbeat, the nonprofit education news outlet, and she's with us now. Rima, good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So explain, first of all, how this state program works, the one that provides migrant families with rental assistance. How do families qualify?
Yeah, so the program is pretty squarely focused on recent arrivals from the southern border, and it is for families who are seeking asylum in the United States and have come to the United States before November 17th, 2023. These families must also be living in a city shelter.
I see. Now, do we know how many families have taken advantage of this program?
Yeah, so based on data we got back through an open records request in April, the total number of families or, you know, households were roughly 5,600. And we saw that about 5,000 of those households were settled down in Chicago apartments. I should also note here that the program covers up to 3 months of rent for families who participate.
I see. Now, you write that most of these newer arrivals, these migrants, have resettled in Chicago's South Shore, and this is one of the city's most segregated neighborhoods. It's predominantly a black neighborhood where the schools have been neglected for a long, long time. And among the big problems for these new students, a lack of bilingual instruction and bilingual teachers. So how is that affecting the migrant students enrolled there?
Yeah, so the families that we spoke to told us that their children are feeling pretty isolated and lost in school. Many of these families, before they moved to South Shore, they were in shelters that were either near schools that had better bilingual resources, or they were traveling a little far to get to schools with those staff or with resources like that. But after moving to South Shore, they are, you know, we talked to one family whose daughter is enrolled in a school where she kind of feels like there's nobody she can talk to. There are no Spanish-speaking teachers. She's a girl who loves to read and has kind of lost that the ability to do that. There's no texts or lessons in her language, and so she kind of relies on a translation app to get through the school day. You know, another family we spoke to actually decided to send their daughter to a charter school that's about 90 minutes away via public transit from South Shore, because they couldn't find a school that could guarantee some sort of bilingual programming for their daughter. And actually, that family has since left the city.
Now, I learned from your reporting that since 1980, Chicago public schools have been required by law to provide adequate support to students learning English. But it's clear the district is still failing to do that. Why do you think that is? What did you find?
Yeah, so, you know, Chicago Public Schools is certainly not the only large urban district that struggles to provide adequate education to students who are learning English as a new language. Those sort of requirements come along with the requirement that schools have properly certified teachers. And that is the big issue that the district has pointed to when we asked them about their long-standing failure to be able to meet some of these requirements. You know, they've pointed to the fact that you need special certifications to teach bilingual education, which a lot of teachers can view as a barrier or an extra step that's too burdensome while they're in school trying to get certified to teach, just teach generally. Imagine a school then in a segregated, majority black, low-income neighborhood that has really never had to teach kids who don't, you know, who don't speak English. That responsibility becomes really hard to fulfill.
Sure. So what did you hear from Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson about this? And have you seen any movement on the part of Chicago Public Schools in general to provide more support for these migrant students?
Yeah, so when we asked the mayor about this issue, he essentially said that, you know, he pointed to the fact that many families are now moving out of shelter, finding affordable housing in majority Black low-income neighborhoods where housing can tend to be more affordable, but where the schools have long lacked resources to support those very students. The district has, and the city have kind of said, well, we need more funding to be able to staff up schools properly, to be able to provide enough resources. The issue with that is that, you know, the state of Illinois has passed a budget that does not include additional funding for CPS more than what the state is already increasing funding for the school district. So, and that's happening at the same time that the district is facing a projected deficit of about $400 million for the next school year. And so as far as getting more support this year or solving this problem now, it feels far off. And I think we're just going to have to see how the district kind of meets the moment.
All right. Well, that's Rima Amin. She's a reporter for our editorial partner, Chalkbeat, the nonprofit education news outlet. Rima, thank you so much for your reporting on this important issue. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
It's Here and Now.
After author Michael Crichton died in 2008, his wife Sherry came across an unfinished novel.
It was just a big mystery. It's like, where is the rest?
Then James Patterson finished it.
Just an incredible challenge for me because Michael writes with a lot of science, and I don't. So that was a very cool thing.
I'm Ari Shapiro, a collaboration from beyond the grave on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Hear about this collaboration, the latest news and more on the early edition, first up at 1 p.m. on KQED.
In Gaza, the violence of war is especially tough on young people. This teenager's whole family was in a house when it was hit.
A wall full of blood, shrapnel, and I couldn't recognize who's alive and who's dead.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Our series next week focuses on kids who've escaped Gaza. That's on the world.
And it's on KQED after All Things Considered starts at 2 today. Support for KQED on this Monday comes from Landmark College, offering academic and social coaching support for neurodivergent individuals at the Bay Area Success Center. Learn more at landmark.edu/successcenter. Visitorscoverage.com, offering both inbound U.S. and outbound U.S. travel, medical, and trip insurance, so travelers are covered for financial risks and medical emergencies wherever they go. Learn more at visitorscoverage.com.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Loomis Sayles, working to fulfill the investment needs of institutional and retail clients worldwide by integrating proprietary research and risk analysis to develop a customized approach for each investor. LoomisSayles.com.
It's Here and Now. Mexico has elected its first female president. Claudia Sheinbaum, the former mayor of Mexico City and a leftist, garnered an overwhelming victory in Sunday's elections. She represents the same political party, Morena, as the current president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Independent journalist Jared Olson has been on the ground in Mexico covering the election. He joins us now from Morelia, the capital of the Mexican state of Michoacán. Jared, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So, Jared, you're in an indigenous area there in Michoacán. How is the news going over where you are?
Yeah, so for the most part, voting yesterday was carried out with the usual movement and at times chaos, but without any grave sort of interference in the voting process. It's a mixed bag. Many people are incredibly happy. You know, this is one of the largest vote turnouts in not just Mexican, but Latin American history, right? And Sheinbaum has won overwhelmingly, right? At the local level, things get a little bit complex, you know? In the indigenous areas where we were reporting yesterday, we ran into political operatives for her Morena party, who in the indigenous areas where the residents voted to not vote in the elections because they actually see all the political parties as more or less one of the same, right? This political operator was openly telling us about how he was paying people and ferrying them to a neighboring district so that they could vote for her party. So you still see many of the local level sort of corruption going on that's often defined Mexican politics for decades. But nonetheless, there is still an overwhelming air of elation, especially for women in Mexico. I mean, this is a historic day.
It is historic, and we'll get to that in a moment, but just expand for us. You mentioned indigenous people not wanting to vote. I have to say, it strikes me that, you know, a leftist party like Morena would maybe consider indigenous people part of their base. Why were indigenous people not wanting to vote?
To be blunt, indigenous people have been some of the most oppressed people in Mexican history, and even today, they see all political parties as complicit in supporting both the criminal groups that extort and that displace them and the extractive mega projects, the mining projects, for example, that kick them out of their communities. So there's a certain cynicism. And in this case, an indigenous Purépecha village, they had voted before the elections that they did not want to participate.
Also, Jared, I know that where you were covering the election in rural areas, that very close to where you were, one of the main candidates was assassinated hours before voting. We've heard other candidates have been assassinated. Hundreds of candidates have dropped out. Did that threat of violence affect the races on the local level?
I think it does. And I think that's unfortunately one of the continuities with the previous style of politics here that's going to continue into the future. You could sense the fear at the place where less than a block away, this candidate for the local government was murdered hours before the electoral cycle began, and where the voters were now being watched over by municipal police with assault weapons as they went to cast their vote. So this sort of quotidian violence and killings and intimidations in the electoral process unfortunately seems to be something that will continue.
So let's talk about Sheinbaum. She's been popular for a while. Tell us about her appeal.
She doesn't have the same, I would say, cult of personality as Andrés Manuel López Obrador or AMLO, right? She is popular simply because she is a very well-educated woman, a former climate scientist, and the fact that she became the mayor of Mexico City and is now the president, that is one of the main appeals. What remains unclear is to what degree her policies may change or shift in the legacy of AMLO.
And a lot of that was aimed at lifting people out of poverty. And people obviously came out and voted for more of that. But then there's also the levels of violence and killings. And Sheinbaum has a real track record as mayor of Mexico City of bringing down violence and killings. Will she be able to scale that up, do you think?
It is true that homicides went down in Mexico City, but at the same time, and this happens throughout much of Latin America, enforced disappearances went up at the exact same time. She does not appear poised to challenge the growing power of the military, who AMLO has institutionalized in Mexican politics. And the military here is probably the most powerful state institution protecting organized crime.
So finally, Jared, Claudia Sheinbaum, first woman to lead Mexico. It's something that hasn't even happened in this country. How big a deal is that?
It's enormous, and by no means would I want to deny the massive elation that millions of women feel in Mexico right now, especially in light of the frightening and continuing prevalence of femicide, gender-based violence, which unfortunately continues to define life for many people here in Mexico, right? What remains unclear, and one of the challenges for Sheinbaum, will be moving into that problem and structurally changing the forces that allow so much femicide to take place in the first place, because those are structural forces. The fact that the police will not investigate, in many cases, femicide cases. So she's got many challenges ahead of her.
Jared Olson, independent reporter, joining us from Morelia, which is the capital of the Mexican state of Michoacán. Jared, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me on.
The Atlantic hurricane season is officially here, and the forecast is for an especially active year. In Southwest Florida, which was slammed by Hurricane Ian in 2022, the cost of housing and insurance have spiked. prompting many to put their homes up for sale. NPR's Greg Allen reports that catastrophic storm has raised questions about the long-term affordability of coastal communities like Florida's Cape Coral.
It's right on the coast, but there are no beaches in Cape Coral. What it does have is 400 miles of canals, giving many homes direct access by boat to the Gulf of Mexico. Jerry Smith moved to Cape Coral from New Jersey 3 years ago. When I ask why, he takes me out his back door where he has a pool, a tiki hut, and a dock with a boat.
If you're living on a canal and you have access to the Gulf of Mexico, it was my vision of what I wanted the Florida lifestyle to be like.
Smith's house received only minor damage in Hurricane Ian, but like just about everyone here, he's seen his insurance rates go up.
The insurance industry has been tough on people here in Cape Coral. I think there's significant raises in rates. And I think it's one of the burdens that people have to really contemplate. Can they afford it?
One thing everyone agrees on in Cape Coral is that the community of more than 200,000 people could never be built today. In the late 1950s, developers bought a 100-square-mile peninsula near Fort Myers, where they bulldozed mangroves, drained wetlands, and dug hundreds of miles of canals. It was a classic Florida real estate venture, with lots sold on the installment plan and advertised as a waterfront wonderland.
Today's new city of Cape Coral is an unforgettable experience. The clean, clear air.
Realtor Sam Yaffe says for retirees and others relocating from the Northeast and Midwest, Cape Coral has an advantage over places like Sarasota and Miami.
People started discovering us. Our prices are cheaper.
In recent months, though, Yaffe says sales have slowed in Cape Coral.
It is unusual. We do have several months worth of homes available.
The main reason for the cooling of the once hot Cape Coral home market is mortgage interest rates, now at a 20-year high. But Amir Neto, an economist at Florida Gulf Coast University, says there's another important factor.
The cost of home ownership in Southwest Florida has increased, and that has pushed some people away off those coastal areas, including Cape Coral.
Spiking insurance rates are a big part of that. A study by a research group, First Street, found that Cape Coral has more properties at risk of flooding than any other city in Florida. Jeremy Porter with First Street says to understand why, you just need to look at a map.
Look at all that water. I mean, there's canals for every home almost. There's a canal. And as you live with water every day, if one of these storms comes through, it is going to cause flooding, and the canals themselves are going to be a source of that.
Following Hurricane Ian, FEMA is now reevaluating the risk of homes in several communities in Southwest Florida, including Cape Coral. The federal agency recently announced it's pulling the city's longstanding discount on flood insurance. The decision related to what FEMA said was improper rebuilding after Ian would immediately raise flood insurance rates by 25%. Cape Coral's Mayor John Gunter called the FEMA action another catastrophic event.
It's unfortunately that we had a Category 5 hurricane. But this could cause other families not to even be able to live in their homes just because of the cost of premiums.
Cape Coral is appealing the FEMA decision. The city recently held hearings for more than 200 homeowners suspected of violating the FEMA guidelines. One of those was Sherry Oaks. Her house had only minor damage after Ian, and she was able to show that at the hearing. But she's skeptical the city's flood insurance discount will be reinstated.
It's actually kind of scary because there are just so many things right now that are going to really increase the cost of living here.
Oak says she and her husband Ray already pay $8,000 a year in insurance, costs that will be going up if FEMA eliminates the flood discount. It's one reason she thinks so many homes now are up for sale. The cost of insurance is expected to keep rising. By 2050, because of more powerful hurricanes and the rising sea level, Jeremy Porter with First Street says nearly every single home in Cape Coral will face flood risk. Insurance, he says, is beginning to reflect the impacts of climate change.
We'll hear from people, you know, the housing market's been increasing. It's been exploding for the past couple of years. Climate change isn't having any impact. And then they'll pause and they'll say, but insurance is killing us.
Homeowner Jerry Smith agrees there's a rising cost of living so close to the Gulf, but one he's confident people will always be willing to pay.
The appeal, the sun, the water, the marine life, the beach, not having to endure winter, all those things make it worth the investment.
Realtors say prices have dropped a little for houses on the market now in Cape Coral. With interest rates high, more than half of the buyers now are paying cash. Greg Allen, NPR News, Cape Coral, Florida.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
Live from NPR News in Boston, I'm Steve Brown. Prospective jurors in the federal firearms case against Hunter Biden are being questioned on their thoughts about gun rights and addiction. President Biden's son is charged with lying on federal gun purchase forms when he said he was not a drug addict. Yet he has pleaded not guilty and argues he's being targeted by the Justice Department for political reasons. Prospective jurors are being asked about their knowledge of the case, their thoughts about gun ownership, and whether they or anyone close to them have struggled with substance abuse or addiction or ever owned a gun. Dozens of former youth inmates are suing over alleged sexual abuse they endured at Illinois detention centers. 13 women and 95 men filed two separate lawsuits last week. Each plaintiff is seeking $2 million in damages. The lawsuits contain disturbing allegations that guards, teachers, and counselors at multiple juvenile detention centers around the state sexually abused the plaintiffs between 1997 and 2019. Sally Busby has stepped down after 3 years as executive editor of The Washington Post, one of journalism's most storied brands. No reason was given for her departure. The paper recently hired a new publisher who has said the newspaper must take steps to correct a dramatic drop in digital subscriptions over the past few years. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for KQED comes from San Francisco International Airport. SFO can make traveling easier with fast Wi-Fi, mobile driver's licenses accepted at security checkpoints, and prepaid parking. More at flysfo.com. Sutter Health, with birth centers that never stop delivering joy and cancer clinical trials that never stop delivering hope. Sutter never stops caring for Californians at all stages of life. Learn more at sutterhealth.org. Cloudy to partly cloudy Bay Area, the coolest day today. That's what the Weather Service says. Mid-60s to the mid-80s. Some cloud cover tonight, lows in the lower to mid-50s. Clearing overnight, and then everything changes tomorrow. Sunny skies generally, warm to hot, mid-60s to the upper 90s inland. Excessive heat warning starts tomorrow for Sacramento around 11. Look for cloudy skies today. Sunny, warm to hot tomorrow. Could get up to 104.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. And Landmark College in Vermont, offering summer programs for high school and college students to help discover their learning abilities and help achieve academic and social success, in-person and online options. More at landmark.edu/summer.
It's here and now. For the first time ever, voters are considering what it means that a former president and a presidential candidate from one of the two major parties is a convicted felon. In the swing state of New Hampshire, recent polls suggest a tight race between Donald Trump and President Biden. Recently, I spoke with voters there about how they're thinking about Trump's conviction ahead of the election.
It's not good for our country at all. I also think it's horrible that he could become the next president of the United States.
Carol DeHaven is an unenrolled voter from Hollis, New Hampshire, one of those independents who supported Nikki Haley. But when Haley dropped out, she decided, despite some reservations, to vote for Joe Biden. She says Trump's conviction only makes her more certain that she will not support him in November.
I just really do not like the man, the person, his politics, nothing.
But if Trump's conviction hardens the resolve of voters like DeHaven to oppose him, it will probably rally his most loyal supporters. So says Chris Ager, a Trump backer and chairman of the New Hampshire Republican State Committee.
They're going to crawl through broken glass to vote for President Trump. I don't care what the weather is. I can envision people on their deathbeds in the ICU saying, the hell with this, roll me in there to vote.
Trump was found guilty of 34 felony counts for falsifying business records to pay off a porn star in a scheme to influence the 2016 election. But Ager doesn't buy it and calls the case against the former president unfair.
It just looks like the justice system has not been applying the law equally to everyone. They seem to be throwing the book at President Trump. So he's kind of being picked on. Yeah, that's what it looks like.
Ager says Trump's guilty conviction could even win over voters who are on the fence about the former president. But it's too soon to know if he's right about that. Steve Dupree has a different view about those voters who've yet to make up their mind. Dupree is a former chair of the state's Republican Party who does not support Trump.
I do think there is a small percentage of people who are undecided, who might be leaning towards voting for President Trump because they're unhappy with the economy or immigration or whatever, who this may well give pause to.
Biden carried New Hampshire in 2020 by more than 7 points, but a recent poll from UNH shows the race much closer. It also suggested that if Trump were convicted, it would probably help Biden win over some of those undecided voters. About 20% said they'd be more likely to vote for Trump if he were convicted, but many more said they'd be less likely to vote for him. Dupree says even a small shift could matter in a close election.
That may very well be enough in this state and in some other swing states to make a difference. And this could help Biden in some small degree.
That's possible, says Dante Scala, a professor of politics at UNH and a longtime observer of New Hampshire elections. But Scala says be careful in this case about making predictions.
My first reaction is to be circumspect and cautious because we've never seen anything like this happen before.
But Scala says there's little doubt that this will cause Trump's loyal base to double down on their support for the former president, just as it will cause Trump haters to recommit to Biden. And he wonders if younger voters, including many progressives who've been drifting away from Biden, will come back now that he's running against a convicted felon. But Scala is not ready to write off Trump. Far from it.
And a number of times over the past decade now, I've said to myself, well, this is the last straw, right, when it comes to Trump and his support. And I've been wrong more often than not.
Indeed, Trump has shown again and again a rare capacity to survive and thrive amid scandal. This one is his biggest yet. It's Here and Now.
For Americans living in rural communities, getting proper access to medical treatment can be challenging.
If we have someone who comes in that we think is having a heart attack, we have to send them to Athens because we have no cardiology in town.
In our series, We the Voters, we examine the state of health care in rural Georgia. That's on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
We'll have it for you tomorrow, the latest KQED news, and also your California report, all for Tuesday morning, and it starts tomorrow morning at 2 a.m. Today on KQED's The Bay, the company that owns the Regional Medical Center of San Jose plans to close the hospital's trauma center. Local leaders, advocates, and even some doctors want the state to intervene. Find The Bay wherever you get your podcasts. Support for KQED comes from UC Santa Cruz, where researchers discovered how often sea otters, a threatened species, use tools when feeding to survive in a rapidly changing environment. UCSE.edu. And PG&D, 811 is a free service to keep the community safe. Before doing any digging, let PG&D mark gas and electric lines so they don't get hit. Call 811 before digging. More at pge.com/safety.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and your NPR station, and from the Music Emporium, guitar sellers for more than 50 years, celebrating the enduring presence of music made on the front porch and center stage. You can learn more at themusicemporium.com. And WBUR with ZSP Media, presenting Beyond All Repair, a new podcast investigating an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything and everyone. Listen now.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks in Boston.
And I'm Deepa Fernandez in Alameda, California. It's Here and Now. Thousands of short-term rentals like Airbnbs may be phased out on the island of Maui. That's because local leaders are now pushing to convert them into longer-term housing for residents. It's something activists have been calling for since last year's wildfires killed more than 100 people and displaced 4,000 families in the town of Lahaina. In January, we spoke with a grassroots community organizer there named Jordan Ruidas, who participated in a months-long protest calling for dignified housing.
So our direct demand is there is an exemption called the Minatoya List, and
These are short-term rentals that are operating unpermitted but legally under this exemption. So under the emergency powers of the mayor and the governor, they should put their foot down and declare that these short-term rentals be switched over to house fire victims.
So Maui Mayor Richard Bisson heard these pleas, and he's now proposing returning 7,000 vacation rentals back to the local housing market as soon as next summer. The move comes after the state legislature passed a bill that Hawaii's Democratic Governor Josh Green signed last month to allow counties to regulate short-term rentals in an effort to confront a housing crisis across the state. Now, critics of the Maui proposal are vowing to put up a fight in court. Matthew Leonard has been reporting on the developments for the Honolulu Civil Beat. Matthew, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, Deepa. Great to be with you.
Matthew, tell us what exactly Mayor Bisson is proposing for Maui. How would the new regulations work if they're enacted?
From what we understand, the legislation is still being kind of crafted, and it won't really be seen in public until June 25th when it goes to the Planning Commission. But we understand that it'll be done in kind of two tranches. The first ones that they're going to try and transition, it'd be a transition process, really just changing the zoning of these particular short-term rentals. These are ostensibly kind of one, two-bedroom and studio units in condominium complexes that were built prior to 1989. And they're usually owned, like the overwhelming number of them, about 90% of them, are owned by people who don't live in Hawaii. So this is what's underpinned, you know, the activists and other measures. So it would really be a legislative measure done in two phases. West Maui would be the first ones to transition, and then South Maui, which is where the vast majority of these apartments are located, would be the second kind of phase of that.
So as I understand it, Matthew, it would basically say to these owners of these condos, yeah, you've been renting on the short-term market on Airbnb or whichever website you're doing it. Maybe people come for a week. I understand like a two-bedroom condo can maybe rent for $2,500 for a week. Well, actually, people need that housing, so you can't do that anymore. Now you have to rent longer term. Is that right?
Yes. So essentially, it means people wouldn't be able to rent them for less than 180 days. And this is, you know, really meant to address the kind of capacity problem that Maui has. And this predates the wildfires as well, but particularly with the workforce and the displacement of residents from Lahaina, it's become much more acute.
And I imagine there's pushback to this proposal because, you know, if you can rent it for $2,500 to $3,000 just for a week, people, locals, can't afford to pay that. They're going to have to charge less for a longer term rental. Is that right?
Well, I think so. Talking to people from the National Coalition for Low Income Housing, which is a non-profit group based in the Northeast, but they've been following this issue, and they said this really, the whole plan is really untenable without some sort of long-term rental subsidy as part of the package. And now we haven't seen the details. We don't know if that's in the mayor's plan, but yes, definitely. And, you know, people like the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement, they're also saying, look, this is all good and well, but without rental subsidies, this is just not going to provide the relief that local families need. The one other thing I'd say, Deepak, really quickly is that the timeline that we're talking about, I think it's highly unlikely. It's I spoke to a Honolulu attorney who has done legal lawsuits in this kind of short-term rental space before when they've come up, and he's told me that there's going to be a lawsuit as soon as this is signed into any sort of legislative form by the Maui County, that there's going to be a lawsuit that's going to slap an injunction on it, and nothing will happen until it goes to court. So I really think the timeline that's being put out there by Bisson and others, is just not going to adhere. There's going to be legal action. This is going to drag on in the courts in Hawaii for quite some time, I'd say.
I guess that then begs the question, where does it leave locals who I understand some are still living in motels and people need housing? Where does that leave them?
Sure. Well, I think one of the things it means is that there are going to be people who are leaving Maui, and we don't have a strong sense of that internal migration yet. We might have a clearer sense of it once we look at the tax returns from April, the state tax returns here in Hawaii, which might give us an indication of address changes and how people have responded. But we do know just anecdotally there's a lot of internal migration or people just making decisions to get out of Hawaii altogether. So that's one thing we'll see. And the other thing we'll see is just, continued kind of movement and pressure on some of these other temporary housing situations, these kohale, they call them, these small houses and villages that are being set up, and that's going to be continue to be a piece of the solution here as well.
Matthew, it strikes me that in some ways this might be kind of like a petri dish of a problem that's happening in other places. You know, maybe a bigger problem of capitalism exposed right here. People who don't live in Maui but are wealthy enough to have an investment condo want to maximize the return on their investment by short-term renting their places. Yet locals on the island can't afford the high prices that tourists can pay, and they don't have other options, and you just said they might leave. I wonder if this kind of a debate is happening there. Are people talking in these kinds of terms about how you solve a problem like this?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, the other piece of this is that Maui County has kind of boxed itself into a business model where they're very heavily reliant on the tax base. So these short-term rentals, they pay property taxes significantly higher than either long-term rentals or owner-occupied. So Maui's whole economic kind of base has really been predicated on the tax base that comes from these shorter-term rentals. And the other thing is they also drive a lot of the activity in the community. So, you know, they drive a lot of business for tourism and so on. So, you know, opponents of the move also say, well, hey, you know, this is also one of the things that helps keep the only industry on Maui alive, which is tourism, because you have the steady flow of visitors and that creates jobs and that creates income for local businesses and restaurants and tourist operators and all that, and a tax base for the county. So unless they kind of approach this holistically, then it's not just going to be solved just because you're able to release, say, a proportion of these 7,000 rentals, and people may choose to just go along with it. You know, one of the other things is, you know, there are other models out there that could be tried. One is a housing trust model, which is the county comes in, buys a significant chunk of these short-term rentals and then puts them into a housing trust, which then kind of provides long-term housing for workforce, fire survivors and all those kinds of people. So there are a whole lot of other options that are out there that haven't really been discussed in detail yet. And so that's going to continue to be, you know, in the background as these other legislative measures, you know, continue.
And I imagine there would be a dramatic impact if people start leaving because they constitute the workforce. I imagine that keeps the tourist industry pumping.
Yeah, but yeah, you can't have a workforce if they've got nowhere to live, right? So that's the thing. I think the other significant piece that people will talk about is the loss of culture. So, you know, Maui and Lahaina in particular and West Maui have very, very strong identities, very strong culture rooted in not just Native Hawaiian culture, but the Lahaina's history as a crossroads. So there's very strong Portuguese, Filipino, Micronesian influences there as well. So the loss of people is also loss of culture. It's not just something that's going to be played out in economic terms.
Matthew Leonard is a reporter for the Honolulu Civil Beat. Matthew, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Deepa. Thanks for talking about it.
And this afternoon on All Things Considered, the powerhouse American soccer team that many don't know about, the U.S. Women's Deaf National Soccer Team. They played their first game in the U.S. over the weekend, and that match made history. Catch that story and all the news live on your radio or your phone. It's Here and Now.
Here and Now will continue until 1 on KQED, and coming up during the noon hour on Here and Now, Here and Now speaks with journalist Roxana Isgarian about her book, We Were Once a Family. It's two families whose children were taken away and adopted by a couple who abused and eventually murdered them. That and more coming up during the noon hour on KQED. Support for KQED comes from Summitree, offering wealth management engineered for life in the Bay Area, celebrating 20 years of helping clients maximize opportunities like concentrated stock positions and RSUs. More at SUMMITRY.com. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers. Donating a car or truck is easy. We can arrange to have the vehicle picked up running or not in most cases. Invest the funds back into our news coverage. Learn more about it at kqbd.org/cars.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from your NPR station, from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. And Road Scholar, a not-for-profit educational travel organization offering adventures for adults in more than 100 countries. Learn more at roadscholar.org/explore.
It's here and now. Trees and shrubs are invading what's left of North America's prairies. That includes the Flint Hills of Kansas, home to the world's largest region of intact tall grass prairie. From the podcast Up From Dust, Celia Yopis Jepson of the Kansas News Service reports.
If you're a rancher in the Flint Hills, the way to help the environment is not by planting trees, but by killing them. The mushrush family has killed maybe 10,000 of them in 3 years.
Elms are trouble. Eastern red cedars are maybe the worst.
Daniel Mushrush ranches on 15,000 acres in Chase County. This land used to be tree-free, but woody plants are moving in alarmingly fast.
So I knew it was happening on my ranch more than what it was, say, 20 years ago.
Some scientists call it the Green Glacier, a blanket of woodland and shrubland unfurling across the center of the country, making the prairie vanish.
It is disappearing right in front of our eyes.
Jesse Nippert is a grassland ecologist at Kansas State University. About one-third of North America used to be prairie. Most of that is now farms, and Nippert says the Green Glacier is ravaging what's left.
These areas that have turned into juniper forests, we're probably not going to get them back. I think we protect what we can protect. We try and restore the areas that can be restored.
Juniper trees called eastern red cedars are gobbling grassland in Kansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Missouri. Wild plum, sumac, and dogwood thickets are too. They wipe out habitat for grassland birds and other specialized prairie wildlife that dry up streams and creeks. Susan Cook Patton is a forest restoration scientist at the Nature Conservancy. She can rattle off all the reasons the world needs more tree cover. Yet she says prairies aren't the place for it.
But there still has been that temptation from the climate mitigation side of things, right? Like people are like, but look at all the carbon that's in that and those trees. Like that must be a good thing.
Research from the Nature Conservancy and Clark University shows that in most of the world's temperate grasslands, adding trees makes the planet warmer, not cooler. Why? These regions excel at bouncing the sun's heat back into space. When you add trees, they hold on to more of that heat, often so much that it outweighs the benefit of capturing carbon in trees.
So again, like protect and love your native grasslands.
Rebuilding forests is often a great idea where they existed in recent centuries, like in the Pacific Northwest. It's generally a bad idea in places that were historically prairie. Also, the woody plants swallowing the Great Plains prairies are making wildfires harder to control. Troy Mueller is a captain with the Hutchinson Fire Department.
These cedars are very volatile. When they catch fire, they look like a Roman candle going off, and they will throw hot embers out, and they'll catch in the wind, and they'll spread the fire a quarter mile.
Red cedars, wild plum, these plants have been around for ages. Why are they spreading so much now, to the point that scientists say the Great Plains grassland biome is collapsing? Carbon dioxide is a key reason. More of it in the atmosphere helps woody plants beat out grasses. The forced removal of Native Americans from most of the Great Plains also paved the path to this green glacier. They burned grasslands regularly. The European Americans who took over, not so much. Settlers valued trees over prairies and planted them on large scales. Tree planting picked up pace after the Dust Bowl to protect farm soil. Woody plants are now so dominant that even ranchers like Mushrush, who do burn their land regularly, struggle to keep them away. Drac Twidwell is a rangeland ecologist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and he says the ranching industry is in trouble. In a video published by the National Resources Conservation Service, he asks people to picture 1 billion pounds of grass rolled into those huge round hay bales.
You could line those up side by side from Kansas City, Missouri, and drive 9 hours seeing nothing but round bales all the way to Denver, Colorado.
Twidwell says that billion pounds you're picturing, it's how much more grass the Flint Hills could grow each year if the Green Glacier hadn't eaten up so much prairie there since the 1990s. Still, he says it's possible to save some of the prairie. The federal government has spent millions on tree removal over the years, but kind of triaging here and there.
We just have more and more and more sites to treat over time.
He advises the Natural Resources Conservation Service on its new, more systematic approach, the Great Plains Grassland Initiative. It's ramping up in Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and South Dakota to help ranchers like Daniel Mushrush secure bigger, tree-free swaths of prairie. After 10,000 or so felled trees in the Flint Hills, he's nowhere near done. Sometimes it takes a whole afternoon to kill a dozen hard-to-reach trees.
It's a lot of old-fashioned chainsaw work, kind of walking rocky ridges and cutting down trees.
But he's seen more progress than ever, and it's a morale boost.
It's not easy work, but it's worthy work. At least we have a roadmap forward.
For Here and Now, I'm Celia Yopis-Jepson.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Anthony Brooks in Boston.
And I'm Deepa Fernandez in Alameda, California. Thanks so much for spending some of your time with us today. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the Museum of Science in Boston, dedicated to inspiring a lifelong love of science in everyone, in museums, classrooms, and online, offering engineering design challenges, digital experiences, live presentations, and more. MOS.org.
I'm Danielle Venton, science reporter for KQED. A scientist trying to explain climate change has thought hard about which visuals to use. Maybe a tattoo would help?
Because I'd want to add a data point every couple of years, you know. So then I thought, well, maybe it'll go up my neck and I don't know.
A walking tour at Crissy Field focused on climate change. You can find that story at kqed.org.